This episode of the Energy Stoners Cafe is sponsored by the Black Arts Matter Network, blackartsmatter.net. Welcome to the Energy Stoners Cafe. My name is Toni Quest, and I'm really happy that you're here. I like to interview the most interesting people I can find on the planet. So grab a cup of coffee, sit down, relax, and listen. You're going to find that these guests are so intriguing, you'll wonder why you didn't know about them before. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Energy Stoners Cafe. I hope you found yourself a nice cup of coffee or a glass of wine, because we have a great guest tonight, and I want you to sit back and relax and learn and listen to what she has to say. Our guest is a historian. She's an ancient civilizations historian, but she's also a marketing expert and specialist, and she does a lot of things. She's written a couple of books. I interviewed her on a previous podcast, I guess about 2 years ago or so, and I was really impressed with her then. Now the things that she writes about, considering what's going on our planet right now, have become even more relevant and more provocative, I'll say. And I just enjoy talking to her, so I felt it would be a good thing to present her to my audience, and that would be you. So welcome, Hollis Jo McCollum. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I've got my nice cup of Earl Grey tea here. I'm ready to go.
I like Earl Grey. It smells good, you know?
Oh, yeah, it's wonderful.
It's a good thing, and this is the place to sit back and just relax and learn and listen and be entertained as well. So, Hollis, since I spoke to you last, the world has changed a little bit. We've gone through a paradigm shift.
Oh, yes.
And the last time I interviewed you was on Seeing Beneath the Surface podcast with Peter Elvidge, and we talked to you about the things that you do. And I do know where I found you. I found you on LinkedIn.com. I find that's a really good place to find authentic people doing worthy things. So your book that I'm very intrigued with is the book that's titled To Save the World. Now, these days, that's a very pertinent title, even though you wrote it before these days. Tell the audience a little bit about the premise of that book, because I think it's a must read.
Well, thank you. It's To Save a World. The title itself is actually a play on the rhythm of the title To Catch a Thief, because I wanted people to kind of psychologically trick them into remembering it. So I
okay.
Yeah, I took the context of the book, which it's a post-apocalyptic fantasy world. So it's a world, not Earth. It's a world called Rashan. And what has happened to Rashan is, you know, all of the gods had this heavenly war, and they all killed each other off. And now the world is in utter chaos because no one is governing the goings on. So the world is actually dying. And it's quite a dire situation. The characters are all living in this world where it can be, you know, snowing and blizzarding 1 hour, and then 2 hours later, it's stifling, melting heat. And, you know, the seasons don't make sense, and this means all the crops are failing, and mountain ranges can pop up overnight. It's crazy.
Should we think of it as planet Earth, or should we think of it as another planet?
It's a total other world that I just made up. The world that I named Rashan, and I did the cover of the book is actually the watercolor relief map that I painted of it. So it's not planet Earth at all. And the main characters in the book are all elves, actually.
Okay.
I do have some humans that kind of come in here and there, but the two main races that we follow in the story are elves and demons. Which demons are not evil in this sense. They're just another race that walks the planet in this sense.
Wow.
But they are, and one of the four main characters is a demon herself and everything, but she's so friendly. You know, she's the most bubbly, wonderful person you'll ever meet, and she just wants to be friends with everyone, and it's just kind of, and there's this stereotype about demons that, oh, they're bad, they're evil, they're dirty, you know, like all these things people think so poorly of them. But in truth, they're just people, you know, they just have a different appearance to them. And And they have some heightened abilities and things like that, that, you know, like night vision and stuff. They have some special abilities that elves or humans don't have. But in general, they're just another group of people that live on the planet. And there's a lot of prejudice that exists both ways, because at the other end of the spectrum, a lot of demons think that elves and humans are these weaklings and, you know, on all this other stuff. So there's a lot that gets approached, because you do have these characters that go out. The main character, if you're going to pick one, is an elf maiden named Esme. And she wants to be set free, essentially. And her culture, it's a very patriarchal culture. The women in her culture aren't allowed to learn how to fight or use a sword and all this other stuff. And she feels very stifled. And so she actually decides to run away from home, because she doesn't want to live like that. She doesn't want to be a bird in a gilded cage. But she does so safely, because there's a troop going out to try to find this ancient artifact led by the captain of the guard, Darian. And she says, oh, well, I want to leave, but I want to leave kind of safely. So I'm actually going to follow this group of warriors, and I'm just going to kind of stick close to them. And then if any trouble happens to me out in the, you know, before I get to a town or something that I feel like settling in, I can scream, you know, they can hear me. They'll come save me.
So there's some magical, there's some powers and characteristics with each tribe, but one tribe in particular, it appears that, the way you've written it, at least, that one of the tribes has magical powers.
Well, not necessarily. Elves can have, you know, anyone could be a wizard, so to speak. But part of the death of the gods is that magic has severely decreased, because the source of magic is dead. So that's another problem that the world is facing. But there is another character who is kind of the, you know, to reference a really popular book series, kind of the Dumbledore of the book, you know.
Yes, okay.
He's a super wise, and he is a wizard with a long white beard and all of that. But he actually is somebody who maintained his magic through, he basically was powerful enough, he was the world's most powerful wizard before anything happened, and he was powerful enough to foresee what was about to happen, and he did what he could to conserve his powers. And so basically the characters, they don't meet him initially, but they're going off, they're trying to find Darian, the captain of the guard is trying to find this artifact. Esme, of course, gets caught up in that quest. They meet up with the other two characters, and they all are looking to find a magical artifact that they can use to help. You know, they're setting out to try to make things better, at least for their people, if not for the entire planet, because the planet's dying and the people are dying. So they're doing what they can to try to find help. And they're getting very desperate. So they're chasing myths and legends at this point.
It sounds kind of metaphoric. And what's interesting to me, Hollis, is that this is the third anniversary of the publishing of this book.
It is. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I started writing it in 2008, actually.
Things have really changed quite a bit. And how apropos it took 2008. I think that, you know, someone, a layperson, which would be someone that's not a character or represented in this book, would see your book as being ironically metaphoric for what we're going through or what we've been through since you wrote the book. Did you anticipate this?
I did not anticipate it, but I would agree with you. And I've actually gotten that comment before from other readers. And actually, I think one of my Amazon reviews from a, you know, total stranger, they actually mentioned that. They were like, wow, this book actually kind of parallels some stuff or some thoughts and feelings that I have about, you know, not actual events, obviously, but, you know, like thoughts and feelings about the social climate that we're currently living in. As an author, I didn't set out to address these things. I just wrote what I thought, and I was developing my characters and that sort of thing. I wasn't trying to write a book about the dangers of prejudice and bigotry and, you know, things like that, but, and even feminism, frankly, I was just writing. But after I finished writing it, people who read it, they said, oh my God, I love how you address feminism. I love how it's not down with men, but hey, let's, you know, women deserve equality and, you know, all these things. And even men told me, you know, who had read it, they were like, I love that you're not down on men. But at the same time, this is a feminist book, you know?
Right. It is a feminist book. And it definitely has a feminist thing, like a feminist slant to it. It almost seems, Hollis, as if you had some forethought.
Maybe.
It's almost like you were seeing into the future, or maybe you were just sort of surmising, considering what we were going through in 2000. Was it 18 that you wrote the book?
2017 is when it was published, but I started writing it because it, you know, I work full time and all these other things. So it took me about 4 years to get it written, and then getting it published was another long journey. As you know, as a writer yourself, getting things published can take.
Yes, I do. It's an ordeal.
It takes years.
And there are decisions you have to make along mm-hmm. the way when you're a writer. You know, sometimes it's hard with an artist in general. It's hard to know when something is finished, you know, and sometimes we keep writing and it's finished. You know, I just anticipate there'll be sort of a follow up on this story as you are in the middle of writing another book that is not yet published. Tell us about that one, if you don't mind.
Not at all. So I actually have, two unpublished works. The one that I'm presently in the middle of writing is actually the sequel to Save a World, because frankly, I had a lot of, and I finished it, I promise. The first book, it's a complete story. There are no cliffhangers at the end. I'm very nice.
Yeah, okay.
But I had a lot of people afterward in the reviews section on Amazon and even, you know, people who knew me, who read it, came up to me and said, what's going to happen next?
Mm.
And I said, oh, I finished it. And they were like, what's going to happen next? And I said, okay.
Yeah, you leave them wanting for more. That's the way to do it.
Yep. So I'm writing a sequel. Presently, I'm in the middle of the first draft of that. That'll be a while. But the other book that I think you're referring to is complete. I did finish writing it. Just last year, and it is, of course, another fantasy novel, because that's what I do, but it's nothing to do with the first book. It does take place, you know, in a fantasy world, but, you know, a totally different set of characters and races and everything else, and I, you know, as you mentioned, I'm an ancient historian with a particular love and admiration for the ancient Etruscans of Italy.
Right.
And I basically made up a fantasy race in the second novel that I wrote about, you know, that where they were entirely based on the ancient Etruscans. And I just kind of took their culture. I put it in a fantasy realm and I magicked it up a bit. and then I put them out, and it's something I really, this particular work is very close to my heart. You know, it's a story that's definitely sadder. You know, I would say that maybe it takes sometimes a little bit of more of a mature reader. You know, kids can read it, but they're not going to get it as much because it is a war story. And it has a lot of themes about political things. And frankly, the whole idea of, you don't always win, you know, like sometimes the good guy doesn't get the cake. Sometimes the good guy gets slapped down 100 times and they don't actually get what they want, you know, even though they tried their best and did everything they were supposed to do. You know?
Well, I can attest to that, as can my director. But I think that what's interesting is that, you know, your stories are based on, even though it's their fantasy, their fiction, they're based on science. They're based on scientific fact. And so it makes it more believable. You know, I think we had a discussion off camera about this, off mic about this, you know, about how people have written things. I had a student, she was one of my best students and just a good person and smart. She was writing you know, an anime, I guess it's kind of a comic book, surrealistic, series called Beloved Seasons, but it was based on, in a weird kind of twisted way, on anthropology. When she went off and I sent her recommendation letter for her to get into art school, which she got into handily, what she decided to do is leave there and go to a different school for a while and major in anthropology, you know, which I believe was her true love. And I think I believe it fueled her artwork in a way that a lot of people wouldn't be able to see, you know, because I remember this particular series in its inception. But your approach to your writing kind of reminds me a little bit of hers, although she's not like a writer as you are. Now, when you write these stories, I imagine you get a lot of feedback on the fact that because it's so believable, because you base it on real things, even though it's fiction.
Yeah, I do, actually. It is, even though it is a fantasy, they're fantasy books. They're not based in any reality, but I do get a lot of feedback, particularly about the characters. You know, I've had people say, "You made me cry. I legitimately had to put the book down because I was crying so hard because I was just so connected with Ethne or whomever, because they were so real to them. I give them flaws. You know, my characters are real people, and I base a lot off of course, ancient cultures and things like that. I take tidbits from history and I apply them to my fantasy plots, and it really helps me develop ideas, quite frankly.
And it makes your ideas very cohesive. You know, I remember being very impressed, and I'd like you could tell the audience a bit about this. We talked about the ancient Etruscans and we talked about the Spartans. And there was the thing that fascinated me so much when speaking to you the first time, and I'm still fascinated with you, is that what I learned is that a lot of these ancient civilizations were ruled by women.
Yes. Or women had equality. The Etruscans, for example, women and men totally equal. Women could be in charge just as much as men were in charge. Gender, you know, they recognized that somebody was a girl and somebody was a boy, but it didn't really play a role, if you know what I mean, as far as their structure was concerned. Their structure was based on other ideas that were more universal, you know, and what you had down below your waist was not something of importance when it came to politics and all these sorts of things.
Right.
And that's something I always appreciated. And as a result, it's actually a very liberated culture. They invented the gymnasium, you know, and men and women worked out together all the time. But when the Romans adopted that idea of the gymnasium, women were never allowed to work out. Only men could exercise. You know, like, no, you stay inside. You know,
I'm wondering, you know, I often wonder why that is. Like, what is the real reason for it? But I'm wondering if in your studies, have you found any particular factor, aside from the fact that, you know, women were basically equal in a lot of these ancient civilizations? Think about it, ancient civilizations.
Yeah.
And at this time, like centuries and centuries later, here in the 21st century, I can attest to the fact that we still have to, I don't like to say fight, but we still have to assert ourselves and often speak up, sometimes fight, to get the recognition that we're entitled to. What I see, and I want to get your take on this, is that in this society, very often a strong woman is seen as threatening to a strong or weaker man or a normal man or whatever, where it wasn't really like that back then, was it?
Not in all cultures, no. It depends on what culture you're talking about. Because if you go to Athens, Greece, you want to talk about oppression of women. They weren't even considered citizens in ancient Athens. In Sparta, yes. Athens, If women even went outside, they had to wear a veil over their face and they had to be escorted by a man, and no one could even call them by their name because they weren't legally considered people.
Wow, that's great.
Exactly. So when you look at it, it depends on what culture you're referencing. But in many ancient cultures, women were equal, or oftentimes they did rule. And a couple of the South Pacific cultures, women, it was queens. It was not kings. But honestly, I'm going to say that the way that I have heard it best explained was by a book by, it's called Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, and it's Yuval Noah Harari.
Yuval Noah Harari.
I'm actually in the middle of reading it a third time because it's so enlightening, but he mentioned something, and he's a male author, and it's an anthropology book, so your friends probably read it.
She's like a quiet genius, that one.
The way he was, you know, and he's talking about it from a different perspective, but he basically just sort of says, hey, in every single aspect, with the one exception of physical strength, women are stronger than men. He was like, absolutely, it's a medical fact. He was like, it's a medical fact. You cannot disprove it. Every aspect of brain power, everything else, emotional capabilities, everything, endurance, everything. Women are stronger than men, biologically speaking, except for physical strength. And I think, and he kind of has this, I guess it would be considered a theory, you know, but he basically says that he personally believes that since women have a greater capacity for compassion and have a greater capacity, you know, just again, scientifically speaking, I'm not talking about my personal opinion.
Right.
This is like hormonally, we have a bigger capacity for it. And just by, if you look at the numbers, that we understand that it's that men with their lower capacity to handle things emotionally, it makes them feel more comfortable to be in charge, and everything runs more smoothly. And so he just kind of thought, oh, so, you know, thousands of years ago, women just kind of let them have it, you know, like, hey, here you go. You know, and his theory was that it was basically placation, saying, okay, you know what, you go ahead, and we'll be in the background because it's not as important to us. We don't need that like you need that. We don't, you know, have the emotional need for as much of the validation and everything else. And because we have a greater hormonal capacity to handle that kind of thing.
Wow, hormonal capacity.
Yeah, because emotions come from hormones and, you know, all that. So that's his theory. And I thought about it and I said, wow, that made so much sense. Because I was thinking, that's what I do all the time, not just for men, but for anyone. Because, you know, I'll just like, because for me, winning's not important, all these things. And I'm that person that, unless you make me angry,
yeah,
I'm going to let you win the game. I might not let you know that I'm letting you win, but unless you give me a reason to put you down, I'm going to let you win. Because I assume, you know, because winning's not important to me, and it's so much more important to other people. So I'll always let everyone else have it. But again, if I feel like I need to put you in your place, I'll go full throttle on you and I'll win. But
that's good. But it's not like you're a schnook or something like that. You know, you're recognizing what you pick your battles. I pick my battles. You know, some people are always ready for a fight. I'm very choosy about who I fight with.
Yeah. Well, and I hate fighting. I tell you, my fiance, we've been together for 5 years now, but he was flabbergasted when we first got together because if we started to get heated about something, my reaction is to go, you know what? I don't want to get into this bad emotional place. Let's take a little break. Let's go for a walk separately and let's come back and discuss this rationally when we're calm. And he would lose it. He would be like, wait, whoa, what did you just say? he was completely like blown out of the water. He was like, you were kind of winning that one. And I said, yeah, but it's not about winning. It's about the health of the relationship. And I don't feel like anything healthy is going to come out of us yelling at each other. So
it sounds like emotional intelligence.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. But that's kind of how I think of it as far as why men have been take note because they, with the testosterone and everything they have a greater need to be in charge. And women have a greater need to please and a greater capacity to take the lump. So they just backed off. And that's what I think happened over thousands of years.
I think it has evolved, it sounds like, but it sounds like it's mutated in recent decades and centuries. You know, women's position and women's, I'd say, women's position in on the planet and women's position within a certain, like, structure of people, men, women. Again, you know, I want to just say to the audience, I would not saying that I think every woman is the same, because I don't know every woman and I don't know every man. But there's certain things you kind of learn as you mature about people. And I think that the writing that you do is indicative of your open-mindedness and I have to say in your lack of prejudice and bigotry because of the subjects the way you position your characters and the subjects that you choose to write about and also the premises of your stories. You know, when you wrote To Save a World, were you really thinking about saving the world? Hollis, tell me the truth.
No, personally, I wasn't. And thank you so much. That is such a huge compliment. You just warmed my heart. Thank you.
Well, it's the truth.
Oh, thank you so much. But I was actually thinking more about the characters' journeys than I was about, like, to me, while I was writing it, the saving of the world part, which they did, mm-hmm. you know, they went through, they did what they were supposed to do. But that was, that quest was the vehicle for me to tell the story of the characters and have them come to, you know, come to their own journey of self-enlightenment. Because all of the characters, they're all young adults. You know, they're all elves and demons, and they live for hundreds of years. So they're all, like, already 100 years old or 120.
Young adults, 100 years, 120.
Yeah, but roughly they're in their 20s. If you were to equate it to a human age. And, you know, so they're going through that coming of age and that journey of, like, really figuring out who they are and what they stand for. And that, the tough situation that they have to go through and the whole, you know, being slapped in the face with their own mortality. And not only that, but the responsibility of the mortality of the rest of the planet. Was a big deal. You know, it was huge, and it kind of makes them come to self-realization more quickly than some other people who don't have to face such hardship and such big decisions. But that's more what I was thinking of was their personal journey. Frankly, they had a decision, and I promise this isn't a spoiler, but I do present the characters with the decision not to go through with it. The thing that they have to do is incredibly horrible and painful for them. And they do have the choice not to do it and just let everything die.
The title in itself is very intriguing and very provocative considering what we're going through now. And I have to say, when you say that they're just like young adults and they're 100 years old or 120 years old, it sort of puts things in perspective in terms of the entity of time and how we are in relation to it. You know, like it's the universe, God, the divine, or what have you. You know, if we were to live to 100 years old, and with the entity of time, that isn't a lot of time. And I think that it's interesting to consider that being 120 or 150 years old is a young adult in someone's eyes.
Exactly. That's kind of why I wanted to write from the perspective of elves, because you have these people who have already lived for over 100 years. You know, they age much more slowly, you know, obviously they're children for much longer than humans are children, but still they've had over 100 years of life experience already. And they're still considered young adults. They still have a few hundred years of life experience ahead of them. And I do like that dichotomy because there are a lot of people, I'm not speaking to anyone specific, But there are a lot of people in this world who are in their 80s. But I feel like they don't know anything. You know, they never, they have all this experience. They are still not awake in a sense, or not even self-aware. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do actually.
And then at the same time, you can have somebody who's 21 years old and they're very self-aware. And it's rare to find someone that age who is, but it can happen. And it's kind of like playing on that a little bit, saying, hey, you can be really old and still have a young brain. You can still have this unexperienced way of thinking and looking at the world, even if you've lived for over 100 years.
Yeah, not everybody's had the exposure. And, you know, we could get into like a lot of things with regard to civilization and just human nature and the different cultures. Some kids, I talked to a kid in my neighborhood and asked her once, when did's the last time? She was like 12, 13 years old, but she had never been to an adjacent city that here, which is not that far.
Oh my goodness.
But, you know, and I realized that maybe I'm somewhat jaded and just assuming that she got there, even though it's, I should know better. And now I know better than to ask a question like that. But I think that there are people that are of age, people that can be, I know people who are senior citizens that have had less exposure than teenagers that I know. And it has a lot to do with the other complications that come on to us that are sort of inflicted on us, or that we're just like by default engaged with based on our class and race and things like that.
And even situation. Like I found out as a teenager that, because I'm a Navy kid. My father was a Navy officer. And so most of my childhood, I was moving around. And because when you're a Navy officer and you can take advantage of some cheaper flights, if you want to get on the cargo planes and stuff, we got to travel to places for cheap that other people didn't get. You know, when we went on family vacations, we would go to Japan or something and we would have a less comfortable flight, but we got to see all these different things, you know. And then my father retired from the Navy. He's one of those love to work guys. He's still, he's 70 and he'll still take on a contract here and there. But he retired from the Navy when I was 11 years old, because I'm the youngest. And then for the first time, I wasn't in a DOD school with other Navy kids and other, you know, military kids. I was in a legit public school, and 90% of the kids at this school had never even left the state.
Yeah.
And I tell you, it was a smack in the face. It was such a weird, surreal experience for me because, and like you said, I was jaded because I thought, oh, everyone's been to at least one other country, right? Like, you know, because that was my experience. Yeah. Because I had lived abroad, you know, but that was just my normal life. And we weren't upper class or anything, but because of the military, we were just around.
You had tremendous exposure. I have a couple cousins younger than me that had a very similar experience with a father who, and my uncle being in the military career. It sounds like to me, and I there was a young woman that recently graduated from college here and has a career started already, but she got a fellowship, a residency in another state. And everybody was so worried about her traveling to the other state. I won't say which state it was. And I said, you know, sometimes you have to just go on blind faith and take that leap of faith. But I remember I gave her a card, congratulations card. And what I wrote in it was, you know, look at the world through eyes of wonder, rather than everybody else being terrified for her to make that trip. And she was just so thrilled with that. Because, you know, what are you going to do? She's going to go anyway. So why be terrified,
right,
and add that energy into something for her? For her, it was an honor to be selected for this particular residency. And so I know that she'll do very well. But a lot of it has to do with lack of exposure. So you've had the opportunity to travel all over the world because of the circumstances that you lived in. And I think in your book, I think it would cause any person in your books to open their eyes and open their mind to more possibility. I don't know what your intention was. Was your intention to entertain, or was your intention to propagandize, or was your intention to just inform in your writing?
You know, honestly, I think my intention was just to entertain, but I have found that the effect is a lot of information, you know, and a lot of different ways of thinking, because I've been very pleased that I actually have had a lot of men who've read my book. And, you know, I'm a female author, and my characters are, I have strong men in the books too, but I also have, the main character is a strong female, you know, she's, and frankly, my demographic is mostly women, you know, it's the demographic, my target demographic is not male, but I've had a lot of men who have read the book and have said, you've really kind of given me a different perspective on how it works, because a lot of, you know, obviously I'm a woman. I talk about how things are through my eyes and through the character through female eyes as well. And like certain situations and things like that, that men wouldn't think twice about walking down that street, but a woman will go, oh no, no, no. I see that right there. I'm not going, you know, like, and it's kind of, and they go, you know, I never realized that that's how the thought process worked. And I said, yeah, you know, we can't just barrel in.
Yeah. I mean, we have this intuition, even we don't acknowledge it. I had a discussion a long time with this person ago about this person about women's intuition. He's a forensic psychologist, so he's got both feet on the ground, you know, and I thought it was interesting, but he respected the women's ability to have intuition. So let me ask you a question, you know, since we're just like on the cusp of our world, at least in the United States, getting ready to change, perhaps. I think it's going to change regardless.
I hope it does.
Within the next 100 days or so, you know, before January 1st or 20th or whatever. But I'm curious to see what your impressions, you know, maybe you could just, if you feel like telling us what you think, you know, I don't expect you to go into it, but a big change has happened. We have a candidate for vice president, a woman of color for the first time in history, history on a major party. Without revealing our political slant, I'm wondering, I know that people have different opinions of it, and the country, the globe, the world is in a very strange situation right now. And as an author of these books who actually puts research behind what you write, even though you might not depict it in the book, you are researching because you're a researcher by nature. What is your take on our next step? I mean, you almost predicted in that book what was going to happen now, unwittingly. You know, I'm not going to coin you as some sort of a soothsayer, but I'll say that you definitely are a very mindful writer because of your propensity to do good research.
Well, and that honestly, the whole history repeats itself. Being a historian, I think that might have something to do with my seeming ability to sort of see how things are, because what I've already, you know, and of course everyone studies history in school, but I have looked more in depth into the past because that was my degree, you know, that's what my degree is in. I still love it, you know, I love my history books and things like that. I read them all the time. I'm in the middle of, you know, an anthropology book right now and another history book, actually. I think a lot of it has to do with, and I know I'm going to sound like I'm using a very like slang term right now, and that I never use, but you know, people say the world is woke, or how woke, you know, what, and I would say awakened, you know, and how awakened or enlightened certain people are, because what I would like to see is, you know, and again, not taking into account any political anything, but just take politics out of it, take out blue and red, and just look at the candidates, look at who they are, look at what they stand for, look at what they've actually accomplished that's positive, and the negative too, but look at what they are capable of or have been capable of in the past. And I mean, if you look at Kamala, you see an extraordinarily accomplished, intelligent woman who had to, you know, she pushed for everything she got, and she made sure that she got her due. And there were a lot of times where she didn't get what she deserved, but she will work hard, and she, you know, I love her personally.
You know, she'll work smart, you know, because women, we tend to work smart most of the time. As long as we can keep our heads, I'm going to say it, out of our butt, things could be okay. But it's when people put blinders on and refuse to look left or right, I always say that's when the problems start, as much as you have to keep your eye on the ball. But listen, Hollis, I have to have you back on the show.
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to.
I want to continue this conversation based on the research that you do, and also based on the books that you're writing. How can someone find your book, most recent one, any of your books?
So there's only one published work right now, and that is To Save a World. I'm currently trying to get my second novel published. I'm going to agents and I'm going to publishers and everything right now for that process, and crossing my fingers a lot. But the Amazon.com is probably the best place to buy To Save a World.
To Save a World, Hollis McCollum.
Hollis Joe McCollum, yep.
Hollis Joe, that's J-O, McCollum.
Correct, yeah. And I tell people all the time, it's a lot easier if you just type in my name, because my name is an unusual name.
There you go.
Because if you type in the book title, it'll show up, but it actually might not be in the first page of Amazon results, because you might get some world keychains and things like that, you know, because the word save a world is in there. You're going to get some environmental merchandise and whatever. But if you use my name, it'll take you straight to the book, and you can get it in paperback or ebook. And I actually have the audiobook in production right now, where it's kind of paused because of COVID and everything. Like, we signed the contract, you know, right before COVID hit. and then all of the recording space was ruined, because they had to quarantine at home, and neighbors' kids are shouting and all these things. So
I know it's hard to get complete quiet. Believe me, I know about that.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So that's a hardship, but we're working through it. So I don't know when the audiobook will be ready, because the recording situation right now is so up and down, but you know, the audiobook will be out.
You do have the paperback, and you do have the Kindle on sale on Amazon. And so I'm just going to say, and what is your website, Hollis?
My website is, you know, all together, HollisJoeMcCollumAuthor.com.
HollisJoeMcCollumAuthor.com.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And all my links are there to, you know, I have my little social links to Instagram, YouTube. I need to post more videos to my YouTube channel, actually, and all of that. And of course, the Amazon link to purchase. And I write a blog on the website as well. If you want writer's tips, or maybe just some insight into how I operate, or frankly, a lot of my blog entries are, if you're working on anything, you don't have to be a writer. If you just need to hunker down and work on a project, I try to write things that are helpful to others, because that's a passion of mine. I like to be helpful. So I try to write things that'll say, hey, well, here's something that helps me when I'm trying to work. I hope it'll help you too. Yeah.
You're very generous of spirit, which is when I was following you on LinkedIn, and that's why I decided to contact you a couple of years ago. And look at you. You're still doing your thing. It's great. But you know what? We're going to follow up on this, because what will happen between now and the very near future is the world is bound to make some tremendous changes. And as you actually, you know, getting through your second book, or the other book, the sequel. And so there'll be more to talk about, for sure. And I enjoy talking to you anyway. Our conversations are always very enlightening.
I feel the same way.
Yeah, so you're going to come back. We'll definitely talk. And again, Hollis Joe McCollum, everybody that's listening, the book is To Save a World. It's a really good read. I recommend it highly. And it's a kind of book you put on your coffee table and hope that nobody will swipe it. Okay. When they come to visit, they'll be like, maybe I'll just take this, but it's available in Kindle and in paperback. And thank you so much for coming to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, it's my pleasure. I can't wait to have you back. I'm going to say goodnight to the audience, and I'll thank the audience for coming to listen to the Energy Stoners Cafe. Thank you so much, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to the Energy Stoners Cafe.